Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 66, right at the beginning, which is old single column, page 741. Okay. That was a long block of papers that we finally finished up in the preceding session on the evolution of life. We now have this little block of two papers, new block of papers on the planetary prints. And recall that the prints arrived 500,000 years ago. Very much in the context of that whole long time span evolution of life that we were going through. And they referred to that fact a few times. So in a way, this is zooming in on that detail. But we obviously are taking the first big step in contrast to the quote-unquote evolution of life, something that is basically just rolling along under the overarching hand of the individuality of the whole, the mother, the god of evolution. Yes, we had a little bit of father-like intervention, tweaking with the life carriers, as they mentioned. Definitely they had to back off quite definitively once you had Anna Infanta, once you had all seven adjutants and the circuitment of the Holy Spirit and personality engaging. Universe's mind made and personality managed. No matter how primitive and ignorant the self is that personality is identified with, there is an implicit trust in personality management. You definitely have many instances early on of unfortunate, it appears, personality management. You take a very circumscribed temporal view, but you have to remember, personality is an influence from eternity. Not some magical influence from some special place in space to time. It's not a temporal ministry. You're not going to find the truth of personality management in some circumscribed space or some limited span of time. And, you can appreciate why one can trust that personality management when it appears to be in very limited hands. If you back up and remember, to think in as eternalized a context as you can. But, supposedly, when you get the first definitive, full-on descending suns engaging with the planetary prince, you should be able to see that father-like intervention of personality management having a profound nature in a shorter span of time. Now, yes, with the planetary prince, that's always spread out over a pretty long span of time because you're dealing with primitive mortals to begin with. But still, they're very overtly. Remember how the life carriers were doing things where, unless someone told you they were doing something, you would think it was all natural, quote unquote. But it's unnatural. It's artificial. It's an art form. It's personality management in a father-like mode. But of course, we all know these two papers that we're about to study. The first one is giving us how it started here, appearing to be in the normal mode where you're going to get some very significant father-like intervention, personality management in the affairs of evolution, where you can see the hand of that of divinity coming all the way down through the hierarchy and manifesting through the ministry of the Lonnandeck son. But when all is said and done, of course, you have the second paper in this pair on the rebellion coming to our world. And you're reminded, no, you need to back up again. And if you want to see the divinity of personality management, even in the face of rebellion, you have to back up. And we all know that there's already been much more goodness that has been actualized than badness in the wake of the rebellion. Because it's a vast conspiracy, this personality management. Like I said, it's because it's an influence from eternity, it's always going to transcend any temporal issues. No matter whose hands it's initially in, God won't be mocked. That influence that's coming from eternity that was bestowed by the Universal Father will have its way in the end. If it doesn't have its way through a Lonnandeck named Lucifer or Satan or Galagashia or Dalagashia, it'll still have its way through God the Almighty. If I go to iniquity, it's not going to stop that, right? My personality, that purposing will still get manifested just through the summation, through God the Almighty, under the same overarching coordinating influence of God the Mother. Right? And that's fundamentally why, no matter what happens with what's bestowed by the individuality of the parts, the Father, no matter what gets done with that free will potential that he's doling out, it is all within the context of a whole. Fundamentally, the Father can trust one of us with that personality because we're in the context of a whole. We're bounded. We can only manifest that free will within that context. If you choose to manifest it outside of that context, you will get your wish. You will cease to exist because there is no outside that context. Right? You are either in the whole or you're non-existent. You're either upheld by the Mother or you don't exist. You can't fall. You can only choose not to exist, choose not to be held. It's very important when we get into, especially when we get to the actual rebellion coming to the planet here, the Galagashia betrayal, to remember that fundamental addition that the fifth epical revelation is giving us, that humans have never had before. That fundamental antidote to any fear, the potential to actually do what Jesus told you to do 2,000 years ago. Fear not, period. Not just when you can manage to do it. No, fear not, period. That's been impossible to overcome our animal origin fear when all we had is the one parent concept. The individuality of the parts, making all these really cool parts, but in a vacuum, seemingly unbounded, and the potential for you to just, do endless calamity, in that picture. We write science fiction stories where, we think that, some evil person can bring about the end of the universe or something, right? You see, that's all predicated on that never having revealed the other parent to us and going off on these tangents with just the one parent, and exalting the parts into something that could literally overwhelm the whole. No, you can't transcend the whole. The whole is always transcend into the parts. The parts must recognize and put themselves in cooperative subordination to the whole, to the Paradise Trinity, and the individuality of that whole, the Mother. So you can engage the horrendous elements of the stories of the rebellion objectively, right, without fear. And you can try to get to beyond the facts of the rebellion, the negative facts of the rebellion, and recognize that same truth that's flowing through all those facts, that's flowing through the most radiant, glowing, delightful facts. There's just one truth, and it flows through all facts. It takes all the same facts to the same eternity. All the facts of time are in the context of the truths of eternity. It can't go anywhere except to goodness. To just be able to face those difficult facts of the rebellion without that fear, and see that yet again, even in the most difficult of times, truth always wins. Right? And to bring that home to you individually, you hear me say all the time, when you're engaging the fifth epical revelation, that's your challenge, to not be fact-dominated as you look at the words on the page. You need to be truth-dominated so that truth can win. The tricky thing, of course, for us with free will, we aren't necessarily dominated by a positive wholeness, truth. We could choose in our ignorance to bring in a negative wholeness, you know, to put everything in the context of error. Right? You can read every word of this book in your negative wholeness, in your error, right, and get nothing but error from it. There's nothing that forces you to get any truth from it. At best, if you haven't first found a relationship to truth, that philosophic mind that has a relationship with truth, scientific minds in and of themselves don't, religious minds in and of themselves don't, like paper 103 tries to teach us, you need that super additive holistic relationship, that philosophic relationship to the cosmos. Now, you need that relationship with truth in order to engage these words and not just put new wine in old wineskins. Right? The book is in my lap because the old wineskins are erroneous. Right? And so, I mean, if you do what comes naturally, that's what you'll do. You'll put all the words in the book into the old error sphere, you know, that we're all living in. And that's the challenge, so that you can become a phenomenon that's just like the greater universe that I was talking about, something that inexorably goes where you would love to go, where you envision you'd like to go, that truth destiny, eternity. You will inexorably go there, but it's unlike the universe that gets that imposed upon it. You have been given free will, and you have to choose to participate in that certain destiny, that certain positive destiny, to strike step parallel with the universe where it's inexorably going, whether you follow along parallel with it or not. Okay, so with that little preface, let's see what we have here as we get into some of these facts. It starts out, you know, quite approachable as they lay out some of the basic facts of the Planetary Prince's arrival.
Paper 66, The Planetary Prince of Urantia. The advent of a Lunanindex sun on an average world signifies that will, the ability to choose the path of eternal survival, has developed in the mind of primitive man. But on Urantia, the planetary prince arrived almost 500,000 years after the appearance of human will.
Okay, so they didn't do it all in one paragraph. They broke it up into these two little blocks. So what was the big element that they wanted to highlight, that they separated this little part into its own paragraph before they gave you the rest of the preface? It's basically what I was just talking about, if you look carefully there, right? Signifies that will, the ability to choose the path of eternal survival, right? The ability to choose to not be just what you are by nature, bound to time. You can choose to be bound back to eternity, to be a religionist. Religion, bound back. Back to what? Back to eternity. You're by nature an alliginist. You're bound to time. So if you just go what happens naturally, you'll have a so-called religious sort of phenomenon, but it won't be technically religion, not consciously anyway. We all know that superconsciously by grace, we're bound back to eternity, but I'd like to have that part of my conscious life, that being bound back to eternity. Right? And in general, you don't have that. You have conscious lives that are bound to time. Again, like it says in the religion papers, it's very difficult to not kind of flip back to what you do naturally and corrupt your religion, having the environment, the temporal environment, the social, political, economic, temporal environment, ooze in and get you bound to time again as a first principle instead of bound to eternity, and then approaching time from the perspective of eternity. Right? See that, they're throwing that in, and that's the big thing that they're saying, you know, is now in play. We had fancier and fancier animals, and we finally got the fanciest animals, and we crossed the threshold, and we had Anna and Infanta, the first true humans, the first creatures from that, born out of that evolutionary process, that could choose to put eternity first and time second. Now, and as long as you do that, no matter how primitive you are, if you're choosing to put eternity first and time second, no matter, you know, it doesn't matter, almost nothing actualizes of that. It's the potential, right? It's the key. I mean, I have value because of my potential, not of, you know, my potentiality, not my actuality. My actuality is not even worth talking about yet, right? But my potentiality is very profound, right? I'm a potential eternal lighter. Forget about finaliter, right? That's very near-term thing. Right? That's the key, the ability to choose, right? Not decide, choose, right? Choices are tied to eternity. Decisions are tied to time. Okay? And that's what you want to do. You want to start with a choice. And then predicate your decisions about time on that choice that's bound back to eternity. Okay, so the planetary prince and his staff are obviously coming to foster that. But they didn't arrive until almost 500,000 years after the appearance of human will. Because, as I pointed out before when this came up, you have this technicality that the life carriers produced this pre-colored race, this very rudimentary, primitive will creature on this world. That, yeah, it's a will creature. It needs to be encouraged to strengthen that relationship to eternity. But the specific task of the planetary prince and his staff is civilizational uplifter. Not just will catalyzer, if you will, right? But specifically, you know, civilization's a choice. That aspect of the exercise of the will, choosing civilization above what happens naturally, initially predicated on the fifth adjutant, a society juiced up to a culture by the sixth adjutant, right? But civilization being potential with the seventh adjutant, the encirclement of the Holy Spirit, and your personality. Right? So that's the job that the planetary prince is coming to do, to foster that element of the will. And those Andonites are so basic in nature that they're not civilizable. Right? They can't muster that sophisticated a use of personality yet. Even with very overt hands-on encouragement. I mean, why isn't a Trinity teacher son going to come to this planet tomorrow? Because we're way too primitive. There's nothing remotely that a Trinity teacher son could do with us. You know, any more than the prince and his staff could have done anything with the Andonites for 500,000 years. Right? No different. We are extremely limited still. In nature. So that's what they're bringing in. That basic picture is what they wanted to lay down first, and now they're going to give us, get into the details a little bit more.
About 500,000 years ago, and concurrent with the appearance of the six colored or Sangic races, Caligastia, the planetary prince, arrived on Urantia. There were almost 500 million primitive human beings on Earth at the time of the prince's arrival, and they were well scattered over Europe, Asia, and Africa. The prince's headquarters, established in Mesopotamia, was at about the center of world population.
Okay, so they're giving those basics. 500,000 years had produced a pretty solid group of humans. And you notice they, instead of saying 500 million, they said 500 million. Like we've pointed out, they do that when they're wanting to remind you that it's heading for ever bigger numbers. So they purposely just bias the way they talk about it, sort of looking back rather than looking forward. So you've got a pretty solid group of humans. You may have forgotten that little tidbit that kind of can strike you the first time you notice that. It's like, wow, it's a lot of humans to work with. But of course, we don't have North and South American play. And so that reminds you of, like they did at the end there, why the planetary headquarters was put where it was. Right? It's or just right in the middle of the three continents. Right? It's a very convenient central, basically central location. There are other issues, as they'll point out, but that geographic issue is important. You wonder, it's like, well, what if there had been a whole bunch of, millions and millions over in North and South America? Where would they have put the planetary headquarters then, They, wonder if they might have selected a different location. It's not like they have to build it there because there's some sort of pre-existent pole there. I mean, they select an appropriate location and they anchor all of the communication grid and whatnot to that location, wherever it is. Let's keep rolling.
Section 1, Prince Caligastia. Caligastia was a Lanonindex son, number 9,344 of the Secondary Order. He was experienced in the administration of the affairs of the local universe in general and during later ages with the management of the local system of Satania in particular.
Okay, you can see how they're giving these little tidbits. So they want us to flesh them out a little bit to not have us just skip past a couple things. Things like that number. So Caligastia was a Lanonidex on number 9,344. Okay, do you remember? Okay, he's a, like I said there, he's a secondary Lanonidex. Those are the ones that basically, they do a few other things as assistants, but basically they're going to be planetary princes. Right, so you roughly need 10 million, right, in the local system. And that's a pretty small number relative to 10 million. Now, it's not, relative terms, it's not as small a number as Lucifer. Remember, Lucifer, very, very low number, one of the very first primary Lenonidex. But, you know, not too much further down the road, you know, in relative terms, with the secondary Lenonidex, also Caligastes. So that's an important thing, that they're in those kind of spear point groups of the you know, the two different flavors of Lenonidex. They'll mention that this is a kind of a cutting edge individual in a number of ways. Yep.
Well, that low number, I think there's probably been how many planetary princes in the local universe by this time? Millions?
Yeah. I mean, so we're a long ways from 10 million yet, but yeah.
So he's also been passed over numerous times.
Yeah, and they'll mention that. Yeah. Yep. But see, they're slowly leading into that, you know, about how he was experienced, right? Yeah. Right. So he's, you know, they were all created way back there in the early days, so they've been around for a very, very long time, and doing lots and lots and lots of things, until 500,000 years ago when they, you know, finally. And he finally got the job he was looking for, this, you know, as a planetary prince. They'll explain a little bit more here in a second. Let's see, and you can see how this works, though, and that's why they're saying it. You have someone who's born into the local universe in general and would have served, you know, for billions and billions of years, has been serving all over, you know, in the local universe, but getting close to him coming here, for whatever reasons, he's been zeroing in on this particular local system, you know, and here for quite a long time, getting quite familiar with the specifics of this local system, how it's, you know, differentiated from the local universe in general. So they're bringing these individuals, these administrative individuals, you know, into focus, so that when they actually get a job, they're bringing that whole big picture of the local universe, you know, hopefully, you know, coalescing that down to a ministry at a very specific point. That's the idea. So every Lenonidex, no matter what job they might be doing, you know, should be bringing that bigger context, you know, to help them have that greater stability. They're not just born into some little parochial space and are clueless about the greater world. You know, it's very important. See, because they're called Lenonidex, remember, no longer one-like expressions. You know, remember the literalness of Lenonidex. They don't embody the integrity of the whole innately. So they need to acquire it experientially and then try to bring that down with them to a focus. And occasionally there's an issue, right, in not properly embodying that and carrying that forward as they get down in the trenches and lose sight of the big picture. Because they very much have to kind of have their head down in the trenches once they're finally, you know, especially if you're going all the way down to this particular world in a very primitive state, you know, I mean, your day-to-day details are are not big picture, you know. They're just like, well, see, how can we help them on, you know, better methods for making and maintaining fire, and right, you know, it's pretty rudimentary stuff when you've been serving for billions of years in this grand, you know, on all these fancy architectural worlds with all their sophisticated technology and all that sort of stuff, right? You know, you're very much down in the trenches, so it's important that they have that. So that's the point. I mean, it's very important that you don't think, oh, it's a small paragraph, so that I can get through it really quick. I mean, you know, remember, you're not a fact finder, you're a truth seeker, hopefully. right? And you can't judge the truth by the number of words. There's the truth of eternity. Eternity is synchronized with infinity. Right? Truth is innately infinite. Right? Paragraph size has nothing to do with the magnitude of truth that you're seeking to strike step with. So you want to challenge yourself. Try to see if you can figure out why did they write that. Okay, keep going here.
Prior to the reign of Lucifer in Satania, Caligastia had been attached to the Council of the Life Carrier Advisors on Gerasim. Lucifer elevated Caligastia to a position on his personal staff, and he acceptably filled 5 successive assignments of honor and trust.
Yeah, you can see how they're already building up honor and trust. They make a point of stressing. It's obvious why they're doing that. Again, long time. And everything seemed going very well. However, at this point, one should take note of something.
Yeah.
They've coined a name here for this Lenana deck. They don't speak English predicated on Latin and Greek and, you know, Northern European and whatnot. Caligastia. You know, what does that name mean? Once you dig into it literally, etymologically, you see the contrast between that designation and that final statement there of honor and trust. Right, what does Caligastia mean? It literally means the one who is entirely darkness and no longer personal. I'm stressing a little bit because you notice that suffix is TIA, so it technically isn't one, right? It's the impersonal suffix, not the personal suffix. That's why I threw in that little parenthetical. I mean, the one who is entirely darkness and no longer personal. And so technically, it's the entity that is entirely darkness. Okay? Go back and look at that very first sentence of section one there. What's the verb after Caligastia? Caligastia was a Lenanadec son. All right. The name is a past tense name that they coined for him. All right. He's gone, you know, all the way to iniquity. Okay. Technically hasn't taken that final step, right? But effectively, he's iniquitous. And he's a past tense. And he's named that way. Right? And obviously they're playing off of they wanted to use Lucifer for, you know, the individual they did. They wanted to use Satan for the individual they did. They needed another proper noun, a name, you know, so they had to coin one. It's like, well, they have that term, the Prince of Darkness. Oh, well, that would work perfectly for the planetary prince. Let's just coin a name that's basically that. The one who is entirely darkness and no longer personal. The entity that is entirely darkness. Calig is darkness in Latin.
Of course, he's on the planet to see his accolades.
Yeah, I mean, and the author, the Melchizedek that's writing this, sees Caligastia as he's penning that, right? Yeah. Remember that all the authors are on the planet, you know, to do this. You know, they didn't beam it in from afar. Remember, they had to all ferry themselves here, you know, to this planet. You know, in the case of the Melchizedek, he's directly interacting with the secondary midwares. You don't need the contact personality. The Melchizedek is directly working with the secondary midware and dictating the paper. You know, and Caligastia might be sitting right there, you know, making goofy eyes at them while they're doing it, trying to distract them. Okay? Yep.
So you referred to authors, but the ends of the papers never do that. Is there a reason?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm just, you know, just generalizing there. I mean, sometimes they're, you don't know exactly if the individual that's has the byline at the end of the paper is sort of solely doing it, you know, and dictating it to the secondary man where's to write down, you know, or is he, you know, you can tell sometimes he's managing a group of people, you know, sort of a little committee, subcommittee that he developed to put together that paper, and he's just kind of overseeing that, you know, that committee work. You know, it varies. I mean, that's kind of a whole other issue about what verb they use to describe, you know, in the byline, you know, indicted or, you know, or whatnot. You know, most likely, I mean, because, you know, in cases like this where it's in first person, you know, you'll see we'll have, you know, the Melchizedek speaking in first person here. I mean, probably the Melchizedek just, you know, did this all by himself, wrote this paper, you know, and hence he speaks in first person, you know, like you would expect, you know, so he's literally authoring it, you know, and dictating it to the secondary midwayers that are scribes. Okay, but anyway, back to Caligastia. You know, Calig, as, and then Tia, you know, darkness entirely, you know, and then that impersonal suffix, T-I-A, that they coin, right? Like in Urantia. You know, so you know, they're spoken it to him by not even giving him the honor, you know, talk about honor and trust like he used to have, not even giving him the honor of using a personal suffix. Right, we're going to use an impersonal suffix for you, right? We don't acknowledge, you know, the validity of you as a personal being anymore, even. Okay, and we're going to use past tense when we introduce you. Okay, so that's what's going on there. But before 200,000 years ago, this is an individual. See, a lot like Lucifer, right? Remember how they. You know, Lucifer had these very similar things said about him back, you know, when we read about the Lucifer Rebellion. You know, this whole bit about, oh, here's an up-and-coming star, right? A little bit of a renegade, right? But everyone is very excited about how they're going to think outside the box, you know, and they're going to really, you know, it's not going to be status quo. This is going to be someone who's going to bring in some very, very delightful, original manifestations of personality. You know, and we're going to see some very exciting things coming from this individual. It's just that the very original, exciting things get produced by the hand of the whole, you know, the individuality of the whole, not that part, right? But nonetheless, yes. So they're trying to point out it's not a coincidence that he ends up, you know, with Lucifer bringing him in under his wing, quote unquote, right? They're birds of a feather, you know. They're both individuals that are just very interested in pushing the frontiers. And that would get a lot of honor. I mean, we know that Michael is a creator son that definitely is one of the creator sons that's pushing, you know, the kind of the away from the center of the bell curve, you might say, right? Of creator sons. I mean, the very fact that, you know, he skipped over the magisterial son and, you know, and did the bestowal son, you know, right after the material son and daughter, you know. Even with a rebellion and a default. Well, that's, it's like, wow, are you certain? That's like way out there, several sigma on the tail of the bell curve there, dude. you know, but, you know. So you can imagine that these individuals, see, there would have been a lot, there have been lots of chatter, you know, and excitement throughout the whole local universe about how they were kind of just tailor-made for, you know, they could tell where Michael was heading with this local universe. Our Michael. Now, just a little bit of a reminder. Remember, we went through this detail when we finally got sort of a little cleanup. You know, back back in the Lucifer Rebellion paper, remember how it says that Lucifer and his first assistant Satan had reigned on Gerasim for more than 500,000 years, when things started to go astray. Remember how we got a follow-up on that and we discovered, oh, that's not 500,000 Gerasim years. Like it seemed like it was in context there, because they pointed out that when Andon and Fanta, became will creatures, Lucifer was involved in the, the accolades to the planet, and that was basically a million years ago. And I say, oh, that must be standard time, 500,000 years, right? Not Gerasim time, not local system time. So, in other words, it's times five. It's 2.5 million of our years ago, right? So, just remember how long as Kalagash is kind of zeroing in on specificity. Prior to the reign of Lucifer in Satania, Kalagash had been, he was here, well before 2.5 million of our years ago. Yeah. So lots and lots of local, experience as he's getting seemingly, it seems like all of this vast experience was all coming to this very hopeful, exciting climax, right? As he's finally given the planetary prince job on this planet. All right. And just that whole bit about being on his personal staff, though, when you have these secondary Lenonidex that aren't serving as a planetary prince yet, they're doing assistant jobs, a lot like that. I think I recall, don't they even say that? Yeah, I mean, they talk about how you have system sovereigns and assistants, back there when they're talking about the non-index sons. So you have these guys serving as assistants to primary non-index and other things like that before they actually get assigned to a world. Okay, let's keep going here.
Kalagastia very early sought a commission as planetary prince, but repeatedly, when his request came up for approval in the Constellation Councils, it would fail to receive the assent of the Constellation Fathers. Kalagastia seemed especially desirous of being sent as a planetary ruler to a decimal or life modification world. His petition had several times been disapproved before he was finally assigned to Urantia.
I see. So you think about, I've already basically given you the context for interpreting that. Right? They know he has this tendency to kind of want to race off towards the horizon, of grand adventure. And it's like, well, that's all fine and dandy, but you're going to need all the more embodiment of the integrity of the whole before we give you that job off there in yonder horizon, of potentials. And so he's having to be very patient, and you're thinking, well, maybe there's a little chip that's building on his shoulder. Why are they always questioning my integrity? It obviously is just ripe to come to a head when Lucifer puts out the second principle and he's talking about the foreign potentates. Right? Yeah, like those ones that kept turning me down. Who do they think they are? I'm a personality. I have this divine nature, and who are they to say that I can't go racing off for that job on the horizon right away? Who needs all the developmental epics on a world? Why can't we just go from first will creatures to light and life in one step? What do you want? Light and life. When do you want it? Now, right? Ask any impatient Urantia book reader. Right. And again, just catch yourself. Like, wait a minute. What's the thing that rebellion and default have in common? What's their foundational fact? Impatience. Right? Yes, self-righteous impatience, that's default. Okay, if it's actually, goes to full-on deceit, okay, then you're going into rebellion. Right? But And, I mean, that's why when I talk about, you know, start with a five-fingered handful of basic favorable conditions, right, to foster your growth, right, the fifth one in that set of five is patience. Loyal, humble, sincere, just, patient. All right, so you don't want to be unwittingly slipping into that lowest common denominator of rebellion and default by letting your spiritual consciousness, which has no clue about time, and when it's informed about time by your material consciousness, develops a distinct hatred for time. Right? Your spiritual consciousness, you know, in its immature form, it's what gets you into this ground level on a ride that you don't want to take. So they don't state it directly, but you can just feel it between the lines the way they talk about it. You know, disapproved, right? Think about how that fail to receive the ascent. The ascent. See, again, it's like, shades of him thinking about it as a foreign potentate. Right?
Deny.
Yes. Caligash seems especially desirous. It's all there. Right there, yeah. They're a lot more sophisticated a self than we are. Those Lenana decks, even a secondary Lenana deck, but they have many things in common. You should, recognize, right? They wouldn't tell you anything about the pathology of their descent into the orgy of darkness and death if it wasn't relative to you. Right? You follow the exact same. Untempered laws of spirit related to mind, right? That same pathology, you'll do exact same steps. You'll have the exact same thoughts, exact same reactions to stimuli that they did that take you down that path. More and more, you don't choose to do the unnatural thing with spirit over mind. You use it to juice up the natural thing, responding negatively to a negative stimulus, right? Spirit over mind is not necessarily positive. It's in your free will hands. You can either use it to respond positively to a negative stimulus, which is what you're supposed to do with that spirit influence, or you can use it to respond all the more negatively to a negative stimulus than is possible naturally. Right? Both are use of personality. Both are unnatural. One is unfortunate.
So you think that he wanted to be on a decimal planet because he spent so much time working with the life carriers?
Yeah, so you've got that. You've got that connection with the life carriers, exactly. And he wants to maximize the potentiality extremes. You know, he's desirous. So you want something where you have the constraints loosened as much as possible so that there's potentialities that aren't normally there. He's interested in the uncommon potentialities, the actualization of uncommon potentialities. That's what's making him salivate, yearn for the opportunity to take the reins. Yeah. So, it's natural. He would be thinking about a decimal world, immediately. And so you he's working with the life carriers on that. He's even thinking, it's like, I'm going to go out and be working with them. And, one of these times they're going to get the idea that they want to really push the limits. Right? So I see. So he's been building up to this the whole time. All right, let's see. Anything else there? Like I said, you see it twice: approval, disapproved. That whole tension that built up in these Lenana decks that led the rebellion, about having to seek approval from supposedly someone above you. You're not the boss of me. And like I say all the time, I mean, that, catch yourself doing that. Don't let that, you know, be a thought in your mind. Right? That's an unwitting toe into the water of, of where these guys went, right? No, everything is the boss of you. Right? Everything.
Right? Only my wife.
I mean, remember, he may, the Universal Father may be infinite, but he's still just a part. Right? And the first thing that the Universal Father did when he came into existence was put himself in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity, to the whole. He humbly acknowledged the fact that he's a part, he's not the whole. Right? He must subordinate himself to the whole. I mean, you know, in his case, right, if he wouldn't be the Universal Father, you know, he wouldn't be God the Father if it, if that individual didn't put himself in cooperative subordination of the whole. He said, no one's a boss of me, right? Then all there would be is God the Infinite and nothing else. Right? There wouldn't be me, you, that table, galaxies, you know, Lananadex, nothing else. It'd just be a singular self, God the Infinite. You can't have part and whole, or you have nothing but a singular individual. You know, that's what we're all doing. That's what Michael is doing with his seven bestowals, getting himself into cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity, to the whole. That's what we're all about. We can become finaliters and take our oath to the Paradise Trinity, to the whole. I hereby consecrate myself in my perfection to be in cooperative subordination to the whole. And that's our job. Self-mastery, so that you can put yourself in cooperative subordination to the whole.
Didn't that change the whole?
Yes. Yes.
The whole way this planet and individuals and as a whole, what we do and what we choose, and what, if we knew that, if more people knew that, because then it's not like, well, now you see just the beauty of that.
Yeah, and the great potential, like you're saying, of that. See, again, it's like, I wonder if the celestial beings recognize, oh, yeah, they revealed the whole and the individuality of the whole for the first time. Right. Just when we need to know that so that we don't go off in self-righteousness, and we're now just unprimitive enough, right, that we can genuinely go to self-righteousness. So step one is you need to know about the whole and the individuality of the whole, your other parent. Right? And you need to work on that consecration. Right, to get yourself in a context so that you don't, you know, in your own mind, blow up, you know, expand to a delusional whole. Just as we finally got sophisticated enough spiritually for that to be an issue, right, and not a moment later, we're given the fifth epical revelation. So if you have eyes to see and ears to hear, you can do something about that new negative potential that you have that we basically haven't had before. Right? It's only now that humans are spiritual enough to join the rebellion. Right? I mean, prosaic individuals can't join the philosophic struggle. Right, I mean, that is the Lucifer rebellion. Right, they don't have enough relationship to the Holy Spirit. Spirit, they aren't spiritual enough, right, to get into the game. Right, it's a game between truth and error. If you can't get in relationship to that holistic phenomenon yet, you can't even get in the game on either side. Right, it's only now. That's why it's here. You know, and I, again, if you, like I said up front, if you've begun to get a, take a hold of the reins and aren't just totally dominated by fear, we should be able to talk about things like that, you know, and without you going catatonic, right? I mean, it's like, oh, I finally get what I'm supposed to do. I need to see myself in the context of a whole. Everything is going to be okay if I just remember to keep that up front. You know, and I don't start thinking it's all about the part me. The whole planet is going to collapse if I don't know. No, the whole doesn't need you. The whole is integrous within itself.
You need the whole, though.
You need the whole for integrity, but the whole doesn't need you. The whole is self-integrous, but no part is. It's only when the part... This distinction is vital, right? It's only when you put yourself into the context of the whole that you can get integrity by through that relationship. That integrity is doled out in measure to you. Right? A measure of the total integrous harmony is poured within your mind. You are grown. Right? That's what that growth is. That expanding cosmic integrity within you. But you can't choose it. You can't build it. Right? Man cannot cause growth. No amount of consecrating your will to the Father puts one additional measure of that integrity into your mind. Right? It just potentializes integrity coming in your mind, but it doesn't actualize the integrity. Right? And again, that's the whole first miler, second miler thing. Right? You have all that consecration of will to the Father, but we still languish and stumble along in moral darkness. We still don't embody any cosmic integrity. Why? It's not for lack of earnest consecration of will to the Father parent. I mean, I'm pretty sure there's no one in this room who can consecrate their will to the perfect will of God the Father like some Christians over the last 2,000 years have. There's been some very profound, earnest individuals. But we still languish and stumble along in moral darkness. Because we need the other half of the story. Okay. All right, so back to Kalagastya. He's really looking forward to this, getting the reins of a decimal world. Okay.
Kalagastya went forth from Gerasim to his trust of world dominion with an enviable record of loyalty and devotion to the welfare of the universe of his origin and sojourn. Notwithstanding a certain characteristic restlessness, coupled with a tendency to disagree with the established order in certain minor matters.
Okay, so just, again, why are they telling you that? Is it because you're supposed to memorize the foibles of some other creature? No, right? I mean, you look for that in yourself. Do you have a certain characteristic restlessness? Have you ever thought, what do I want? Fill in the blank. When do I want it? Now. Or have you ever heard someone say that and felt a spiritual gravity towards that declaration? Did you feel a pull towards that? Right? I mean, they are putting out, you know, something that has a spiritual drawing power. Do you just let yourself be drawn to it? Or do you stand back and carefully reflect on it and say, well, okay, I see the spiritual surface. Let me use my insights, like my third cosmic intuition, my spiritual insight, to penetrate through that spiritual surface. Is it solid or hollow? Use your insight, right, to see inside, right? Is it just a glaze of spiritual candy? Or is it solid spirit? Right? If it's the whited sepulcher, right? If it's a glaze of spiritual candy, but it's hollow and filled with dead man's bones like the sepulcher, right? What do we call that construct? empty on the inside, beautiful, spiritual, draws you with spiritual gravity inexorably on the outside. What do we call that construct? A sophistry. You must be sophistry proof. You can't just let yourself, be a helpless victim of spiritual gravity, being drawn to that glaze. Because you're envisioning it's filled with light and life. No, it's filled with the orgy of darkness and death. That's fear. Right? It's not as it appears. There's a difference between appearance and reality. Right? That it's problematic enough if in material issues you don't discriminate between appearance and reality. If you think that, that the appearance is the reality and predicate a whole bunch of decisions on that assumption. Right? But that usually just leads to you literally falling on your face, and skinning your knee and your nose in a material way. If you don't discriminate when you're dealing with spirit substance between appearance and reality, that has doesn't just have a relationship to time, that has a potential relationship to eternity. Because your personality is spirit pattern, it takes a hold of that spirit, and ties you back to eternity, right? That's when it gets, that's where real harm can befall you. Materially, no real harm can befall you. Actual harm, yeah, but not real harm, not tied to eternity harm. Right, so, this is very important stuff to notice those, naturally your spiritual consciousness, your immature spiritual consciousness is restless. That's what it is naturally. It doesn't naturally have peace that passes all understanding. Otherwise, what would the passes all understanding part mean? Right? Everyone would understand it if it was natural. No. Non-restless relationship to spirit energy is artificial, is unnatural.
An enviable record,
Yep.
The restlessness was probably just maybe not so bad at that time.
They weren't thinking of that restlessness as inherently negative. And that's an important thing about what I was just saying too. Don't think of, you're not by nature sinful and unclean, quote unquote, from what I was just saying, because you're naturally restless. No, you're supposed to be that. Because it's self-animating substance. It's a relationship to spirit substance, self-animating. That's just what it is. That's its potential, that it doesn't have an off switch. Right? You don't have to change the batteries on it. It's very handy stuff. Okay? But, use with caution. Right? We all know that occasionally we make things, materially, it's handy, to be able to punch the big red button and turn it off before the room blows up, right? At least
put a fuse in it.
Yeah, right? Right? So spirit substance, before you start playing with it, you need to be able to learn by looking and not merely by leaping, right? Because there's no off switch on the stuff. And then that whole bit of tendency to disagree with the established order in certain minor matters. See, as soon as you had the dawning of the sixth adjutant in the collective in the middle of the 20th century, right, you started to see a very overt collective manifestation of that. Tension building up in humans. Question authority, things like that. It started with a bumper sticker for Caligastia too, right? That whole bit, like they're stressing there, certain minor matters, it wasn't a big deal, it's just a bumper sticker. But it's a mustard seed. Again, if it's spirit substance, it's a mustard seed, like Jesus said, right? And you don't want that mustard seed to do what mustard seeds do in a negative way. And you have to choose that positive growth of that mustard seed. You know, that's the gift that the Father gave you. You know, He didn't make it natural. He gave you free will, not unfree will. Right? Didn't give you just a magic fixes everything positively influence. Right? Right. So those are the important elements. I know I'm kind of belaboring some of this, but I mean, again, just reading this as the facts of this history, who cares? Right? The whole point is the truth of this, right? And how important this is. I mean, because, you know, you want to catch yourself like Jesus was catching the disciples. You know, as soon as he was getting them kind of spiritually animated as a spiritual uplifter, you know, he saw the beginnings of pride, which is a, you know, that you can't have until you have spirit. Right? It's a spirit word, pride. And you remember how he came down like a ton of bricks on him, right? Because it's, okay, it's a double-edged sword, right? The moment, you know, you're playing with stuff that has no off switch, guys. Right? So, I mean, you need to, you know, I need to sober you right from the beginning. Yeah, it seems harmless. It's just a little mustard seed. Hey, what harm could that be? Right? But you're watering it, dude. Okay? And it's going to grow. All right. As long as it's, you know, in suspended animation and not being watered, that little mustard seed that we all have, you know, it's no potential harm. The moment you start consciously watering... Okay, yeah, so anyway, that just noticing that, you know, do you have that little, you know, that tension with the established order? You start thinking in two father-like terms instead of forgetting about the God of evolution. Right? You want things to change in a fiat fashion. You don't have time for the whole evolutionary process. You see the established order as a roadblock to the great things you can envision that the future could be, rather than the established order is the evolutionary means through which that end will eventually be reached. Right? The established order is not eternally divine, existentially divine, but it's temporally divine. You know, every moment in the evolutionary process is a divine dispensation. Right? There's truth flowing through that. It isn't it, but truth is flowing through it, and you got to see it that way. You have to respect what the evolutionary process has produced. It's not that you don't try to find ways to, you know, if you can, to be a catalyst for the process, but you have to respect that as soon as you can envision a better future, you have to figure out that my hour is not yet come thing that Jesus had to figure out. You got to figure out when you're supposed to apply that envisioning of a better future and when you shouldn't be. If you try to do the, you know, a good thing too soon, it's a bad thing. Right? It's like, no, good is just existentially good. No, you're not doing anything in eternity. You're doing it in time. You got to figure out, you know, which time? This time? That time? A time past my life? Maybe I can have foresight beyond the span of my life. Gee. Right?
It's like when the apostle said to Jesus, you know, that they wanted him to stay. And most people on the planet think, well, love can't be a bad thing. You know? But it's like, it can be.
Is love a personal thing? Is personal free will? Of course, you know, you can take anything that's potentially positive and do it negative. All good things, for instance, all good things taken to extreme become bad. Not to mention, like I was saying, I mean, all good things done in an inappropriate place or time can be bad. It's like, well, how in the heck do you know what place or time? There's this thing called wisdom, which science can't help you with, and religion can't help you with. Wisdom is a philosophic word.
Also, on this, you just read about the tendency to disagree with established order, even in certain minor matters.
Yeah, and again, we'll continue on here, but just, again, there's nothing innately bad about a tendency to disagree with these established order. If that was innately bad, would they have assigned him as a planetary prince? Of course not. That was innately bad. It's just, if you recognize that genetically you have that tendency, then, you need to work on, for instance, that favorable condition of humble. Okay, all the more, right? The more you have that tendency, the more humble you need to be. Okay? For instance, okay. So just, try to have the courage to assess yourself relative to these things. Yeah, you're not trying to figure out if you're going to survive or not. I hope you're taking your salvation for granted, right? We're 2,000 years down the road from the fourth epical revelation from Pentecost. You should be taking your salvation for granted. That has nothing to do with you and your salvation, what we're talking about here. Right? It has to do with whether or not you're supplying the favorable conditions to be grown from where you started as a child of God. I mean, the good news of Pentecost is that merely as a child of God, you're saved by grace. Just because you're a child of God, not because you've made it the third circle or whatever and gotten a thought adjuster or anything like that. Just any old child of God, right? Seventh circler, saved by grace. So you don't have to worry about that issue. Right? But you do have to worry about the issue that God expects you to grow up. Right? There aren't children of God in eternity. There's adults of God in eternity. Right? If you want to get to eternity, you've got to ascend from childhood to adulthood. Right? And that's a separate issue from salvation. Okay, let's keep going here.
I was present on Gerasim when the brilliant Caligastia departed from the system capital. No prince of the planets ever embarked upon a career of world rulership with a richer preparatory experience or with better prospects than did Caligastia on that eventful day 500,000 years ago. One thing is certain. As I executed my assignment of putting the narrative of that event on the broadcast of the local universe, I never for one moment entertained, even in the slightest degree, any idea that this noble Lanonendek would so shortly betray his sacred trust of planetary custody and so horribly stain the fair name of his exalted order of universe sonship. I really regarded Urantia as being among the five or six most fortunate planets in all Satania, in that it was to have such an experienced, brilliant, and original mind at the helm of world affairs. I did not then comprehend that Caligastia was insidiously falling in love with himself. I did not then so fully understand the subtleties of personality pride.
See, so there it is. We've already pointed that out, right? I mean, is there any potential negative issues with love? Yes. Right? And, of course, there's the pride thing, right? And those are both spirit words, right? Again, and love is a personalized spirit word, and they're just stressing personality pride, right? And it's not that there's something innately bad about certain kinds or phases of spirit substance, right? We aren't in the old dual spiritism model, right? I mean, humans have always rationalized it like, oh, there's two kinds of spirit, white spirit and black spirit, right? And you don't want that black spirit to ooze in your ears or something, and take you off, on a tangent you don't want to go on. White smiths and blacksmiths, right? Is there wielding the powers of the two substances, and that sort of stuff, right? We have that whole history of that. No, there's just one kind of spirit substance, and it's in your hands about whether you do something positive or negative with it. You can turn it back on yourself, right, that love. You know, if you go up to self-respect, as you should, on the fourth level of meaning, but if you take that self-consideration any higher than that, it starts to go negative. All good things taken to extreme become bad. You know, gets a little bit negative when you take it up to the fifth is self-esteem, and it goes full negative when you take it up to the sixth, the level of love, right, as self-admiration, self-love. But again, you see him stressing. I mean, it seems like this is going to be so fantastic. You have these extreme potentials on this planet. You have the perfect Lenana deck for this. A Lenana deck that's been working his entire existence, billions of years leading up to be just the right kind of Lenana deck to steward these very atypical, uncommon potentials towards light and life. You know, you notice they mentioned in there about his originality, right? Like I was stressing before, it's like, oh wow, this one is really going to think outside the box, right? Besides kind of all that we've been talking about a whole bunch here, that you have all this potential and it makes it all the sadder to record 200,000 years ago. Notice that, you know, we went to first person on the author, and we also know why this particular Melchizedek got this job. Remember, they pick a person to either author or shepherd a particular paper because they're the most intimate with those issues, and can speak with the greatest experiential authority. I know whereof I speak, exactly. Right? See, you see it right there. I mean, he literally is the one who is given the job to put this on the broadcast. Right? So, right, he's just testifying to, you may wonder why in the heck I got this job, right, to be in charge of this paper. Well, here's why. Just as they always say, I mean, the Melchizedeks, they're always looking at the Lenana decks. And our system rebellion, they say that they learned a lot in the wake of that. Remember, they started a whole college, new college, to teach the wisdom that the Melchizedeks acquired in the wake of the rebellion. Just how subtle this is, right? I did not then so fully understand the subtleties of personality pride. Which Jesus, like I was saying a little bit ago, analogized with the mustard seed. It's like, oh, there's no big issue there. Look how tiny it is. That couldn't, develop into any big issue. It's like, no. Remember, spirit, you progress in relationship to spirit geometrically. Not arithmetically, like you do with matter.
Wasn't he talking about faith with the mustard seed,
though? Well, sure. But see, he's talking about spirit. And I'm just pointing. See, you take a specific illustration like he was doing, a particular analogy. That analogy has a lot more, validity when you recognize the fundamental truth. It's like with the levels of meaning. Right? The levels of meaning aren't just that illustration of the little levels of meaning, that particular, taking the golden rule up to levels, that it's something much more fundamental and more universal. That's just a particular illustration of the levels. It's not the levels itself. The mustard seed analogy, that's why I'm just kind of stressing that. It's a very helpful analogy, that geometric relationship between the seed and what it grows into. Right? That was Jesus, that's why he used that analogy. Right? And if you think that, they tell us there's this other substance, spirit substance. Well, I think it's just like what I've experienced with material substance. It's like one brick, two bricks, three bricks. You plod along and you have this arithmetic progress with matter. The spirit's not like that.
Oh, it's one brick, two brick, many brick.
Right. No. It's 2, 4, 8, 16. Right. Exponential, right?
It's a beanstalk. It's just a mushroom.
Yeah, right. It's like the magic beans, right? That geometric relationship between, well, it's just a little bean. I see that's another story playing off of that. So that it's important to appreciate that. The potential that's bottled up, like we often talk about, this whole bit of consecrating to the two parents. It takes just a tiny little bit of consecration of your will to the perfect will of God the Father. To potentialize a vast amount of the growth that is that progressive consecration of your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. You know, like they say up in paper 117, section 6. Right? I mean, the little bit of consecrating your will that you do kind of basically all you've done already, that powers your whole local universe, right? I mean, remember they tell you the whole local universe is about increasing your relationship to the other parent, to the mother. Because you don't need any more father. You got plenty of father just in that tiny little start, especially because you get an adjuster to amplify it. Right? You don't need a lot more father. You've got a lot of actualizing to do predicated on that potential. You know? So think more about, you know, instead of trying to consecrate your will more and more and more, which is just going to end up kind of turning around and you're going to blow yourself up like they're talking about here, you know, just trust that you've got that, basically. And you just need to set in for the long-term patient process of being grown now, predicated on that willingness. Right? You know, you ever think about, I have a willingness. For what? Right? I mean, think about how everyone that finally kind of makes that big step, you know, they go from darkness to consecrating, you know, their will. And then a little ways down the road, they're going, okay, well, now what? You know, and they talk to their pastor or whatnot, or their fellow Christian friends or whatever, you know, fellow religionists. It's like, well, you know, and no one has the answer to that. It's like, you see, because it's never been revealed to us. It's like what you do after step one. Jesus didn't, you know, do that. I mean, Jesus was carefully avoiding talking about step 2, 3, 4 and whatnot. Especially in his public ministry. It's just so important to, you know, to recognize that, okay, I have a willingness, and then there's the obvious question, a willingness for what? A willingness to exalt myself? No, I don't want to do that. Well, that's all you'll end up doing. See, if you don't have sort of the big picture out there to, you know, project your thoughts toward, you know, it'll end up stalling at the end of your nose. And the willingness will just feed back, right? And you'll fall in love with yourself. You know, that's the thing. You need to open up to the big picture so that you don't have that very unfortunate possibility in play of where it just wraps back around and never gets beyond your navel.
Why do you call me good?
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. No, goodness is out there. I'm not the source of goodness.
I'm Jesus.
Yeah, I know, but I'm speaking for Jesus, right? When he's saying that, right? He's saying, no, don't look to me, you know, kind of like what you were saying, you know, they were all wanting to just, you know, follow along parrot-like, you know, imitating him. And it's like, no, you know, you need to look out. I'm not the source. I'm an example for you. But you know, you don't want to have a religion about me. You don't want to talk about me, says Jesus. Right? Don't go about talking about Jesus, talking about me. Okay, follow my example. I didn't go about talking about me. I went about talking about God. That's what you're supposed to do. Of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. Okay. Let's look at Jesus' life. Did he go about talking about Jesus? Did he write down his life and teachings so that everyone could talk about it? No. Right. No, that's a religion about Jesus. Right. If you talk about Jesus, that's a religion about Jesus. Right. No, you're supposed to be talking about God. Well, God is so abstract. Yeah. He's your spiritual father. That's innately abstract. Right. You got to get past the end of your nose, right? To even figure out what Jesus was talking about there. Now, if you're still thinking he's, you know, anthropomorphically extrapolating out from you, then he's not your spiritual father. He's your exalted material father, and you want him to do material things for you and yada, 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 yada. Right? No, he's your spiritual father. He doesn't do anything with matter. He's not going to fix your hangnail. Right? It's not. He's your spiritual father. You know, and 2,000 years down the road, we still haven't figured that out. Right? You know, we're still not picking up, you know, we're failing just like the apostles did and in translating everything Jesus said into a material analog, so-called analog. So again, it's just, that's the challenge, you know, to go beyond the material and, you know, but now come back around to this, you know, okay, so I go beyond the material, like Jesus was encouraging me to do, and then immediately you're out of the frying pan and into the fire. It's like, now you have a whole new set of issues. Now that you're actually differentiating spirit from matter, you're actually starting to relate to genuine spirit, not spirit falsely so-called, you know, i.e. fancy matter. Now you've got to deal with the laws of physics energy, you know, physics substance. Okay, and that's where falling in love with yourself and personality pride come in. That's the physics of spirit, not the physics of matter. Okay, we should be able to do one more section here, I think. Let's get a little bit into the, you know, we all know that it's not just about this one individual coming. He comes with a whole staff. And that's very important because there's a Lenanadec sitting right there, and none of us could see that Lenanadec, interact with that Lenanadec, couldn't speak to us. What would be the point? Right, there has to be some way for this descending sun to have a way to cross the divide between their nature and the mortals that he's supposed to minister to. So there must be a whole hierarchy of interfacing, right, between the core individual, the secondary Lenanadec son, and the mortals he's come to be the civilizational uplifter for. He needs a staff.
Section 2, the Prince's Staff. The planetary prince of Urantia was not sent out on his mission alone, but was accompanied by the usual corps of assistants and administrative helpers.
I mean, it's this weird little tiny paragraph, but just you may recall they what was that?
It was tiny paragraph.
Yeah, another very tiny paragraph. Yeah, and so in this case, remember we had a whole paper on planetary princes, you know, way back, and right, we had a whole paper on a discourse on Lenanadec, right? I mean, they're reminding you of that, you know, like if you flip back there, there's things like the entire staff of a world ruler consists of personalities of the infinite spirit and certain types of higher evolved beings and ascending mortals from other worlds. You know, we're going to get the corporeal staff here in a minute. Such a staff averages about 1,000. Okay, so, you know, they told you things like that. You've got You have a lot of angels, various flavors, probably. Plus, there's going to be beings they haven't even revealed to us. There's going to be, you know, this whole big staff of various, you know, quote unquote, more what we think of as celestial beings as assistants and administrative helpers. Okay, so they've reminded me of that. Okay, what else?
At the head of this group was Dalagashia, the associate assistant of the planetary prince. Dalagashia was also a secondary Lenanadec son, being number 319,407 of that order. He ranked as an assistant at the time of his assignment as Caligastia's associate.
Okay, so he was doing the assistant job like Caligastia had done for a while. So you see a very similar thing. Now we got a, you know, much bigger number though. Right, and so again, you've got the, you know, it's obvious just by the numbers about, you know, who's the spear point here of the two. But recall on that, you know, you have things like, let's see, where was it? Oh yeah, where they say in there that a planetary prince. If you're wondering where I am, I'm going back to paper 50 on the planetary princes in section 2. A planetary prince may also have as assistants one or more of the third order of his own group of sonship, and sometimes, on certain worlds, one of his own order, a secondary Lunanodec associate. Okay, see, so, you know, just recall that. That's not always the case that there's a two secondary Lunanodecs. And remember, we've speculated a little bit. Remember when we read about the rebellion and they talked about Abaddon? You know, and how he's still chief of staff of the rebels here, and you're going, oh, wait a minute, all the seraphim and, you know, midway rebels, you know, all, were all taken off at Pentecost. So if the ones that are still here must be not, you know, of those types, oh, probably Abaddon is a tertiary Lunanodec, you know, like they say right there, that you can have one of the third order. You know, so that's, you know, he definitely had another one of the second order. And most likely, that's who Abaddon is he has, there's a tertiary Lunanodec. And who knows who the other rebels that are still here besides Caligastia and Daligastia and Abaddon, you know, that Abaddon is still kind of chief over. If you're, I guess I should remind you where that is. Let's see, that's... let's see, where is that? That's, you know, back in the rebellion paper. Can I find that easily? Probably can't. Oh yeah, I just did. Okay, yeah, it's that's in paper 53, section 1, towards the end. Abaddon was the chief of the staff of Caligastia. He followed his master into rebellion and has ever since acted as chief executive of the Urantia rebels. And it's noting that last part. It's like, wait a minute. yeah. So we're just seeing how, again, when they told us about planetary princes in general, they said, well, sometimes, you know, and occasionally. We have, it's like all of these sort of exceptional things are, you know, are in play here. You don't normally have a tertiary. You don't normally have two secondaries. So the whole thing is this. Is obviously geared to actualizing these very uncommon potentials, you know. And he's going to need lots of help with this. It's going to be more complicated than normal. One Lunanodec can't do it all by himself. With, you know, a few angels. Yeah.
Difference between the D and the C in the etymology.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So right. Thank you for reminding me. I was going to get to that. I just about forgot. So here you see, it's obviously Daligastia. Seems to be just the word Caligastia with the C replaced by a D. Okay. Remember that they use that kind of coinage where they use the letters as letters, like U versa, you know, U minor, U major, right? They're just using that letter U. Or ABC the first, or, you know, they use the letters. And so what are they doing here? They've just taken the name Caligastia and replaced the C by a D, so it doesn't have any literal immediate etymology, right? It's just, okay, so in other words, it's the one, you know, if again, you know, remember, you can always look up in the etymology, right, that's in the library, you know, like, what did I say there? The one who is next in standing after and who stands with Caligastia, because D immediately follows C in the alphabet, right? So you have those two things. It's not only, it's not B, because you want it to be after the C, you know, so they have that proper relationship, you know, who's boss, who's assistant. And but you also want it, you know, very much, they're right next to each other, right? They're a very tightly coupled team, you know, or partners. So that's all they've done with that. I won't go into them, but they did note there are some when you coin it like that, replacing the C by a D, there are some things that it connotes, but those are just secondary. Look it up in the etymology if you're curious. But the immediate thing is just that, you know, it's the letter D instead of C. So keep going.
The planetary staff included a large number of angelic cooperators and a host of other celestial beings assigned to advance the interests and promote the welfare of the human races. But from your standpoint, the most interesting group of all were the corporeal members of the Prince's staff, sometimes referred to as the Kaligasha 100.
It's just, you know, quickly there, you see that they are reminding it that you have all these beings they don't reveal. You know, and a lot of times, even in the things that they're talking about, those beings are in play. Other celestial beings, you know, who you don't know. And you can even wonder, I mean, most likely, like I said, anything that's basically like an angel, you know, in a way, the midwayers are kind of like angels. I mean, probably anything that's like that, that joined the rebellion, were taken off. But someone, you know, that's sufficiently different, like a tertiary Lananadec, probably say wouldn't have been taken off. And so, you know, who exactly these others are? There's even, I've pointed out, there's even the possibility, what if there were some visitors on the planet at the time of the rebellion that got sucked up in the rebellion, right, and weren't an angel or whatnot, right? They wouldn't have been taken off. Whoever that is that Abaddon is, you know, the chief executive over, would be, you know, these quite different unrevealed beings that they occasionally allude to like that.
Okay. The other fun thing about using the D instead of the C is they're still painting D with the same brush they painted C with, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Was.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, if you look at my little parenthetical in the etymology there's some interesting plays that come along for the ride by changing the C with the D that sort of play into that. But very immediately, it's yet another entity that is entirely darkness, right? Now. And you use verbs like was. Yeah. Okay.
These 100 rematerialized members of the Prince's staff were chosen by Kaligastia from over 785,000 ascendant citizens of Gerasim who volunteered for embarkation on the Urantia adventure. Each one of the chosen 100 was from a different planet, and none of them were from Urantia.
Yeah, so you've got that issue of... I think that most people who are longtime readers remember that none of the Prince's staff were from this planet. And not only that, they were each from a different world.
About the 780.900.
Yeah, and
we're so... happy they didn't get picked.
Yeah, especially if they humbly recognize, you know, I didn't have a lot of wisdom, you know, embodied yet. Oh, I'm glad I didn't... Yeah, because I would have gone the way of Nod. Yeah. Be careful what you volunteer for. Again, see, you know, that whole bit of you're playing with stuff that's potentially related to eternity now, guys. You know, and the thing there that we might want to just mention, remember how we, you know, and people often talk about this a lot, you know, the whole bit about how many... you know, ascending mortals who were Gerasim citizens at the time of the rebellion stayed loyal. You know, they all did. 187,432,811. You know, and,
didn't seem like a
And that whole bit about it doesn't seem like a lot, you know, but remember, it's just that class that happened to be there. It's just, you know, relatively small classes that go through rather relatively quickly, you know, as Gerasim citizens. You know, and so, you know, it's in that context. You've got something on that order there. The class that's there, you know, 500,000 years ago. You know, so 785,000, it seems like, I mean, that's a lot of ascending mortals, it seems, that haven't fused with their adjuster yet.
Yeah, that's true.
See? You know, just as a raw number, it's like, wow, that's a lot of mortals that haven't fused with their adjuster yet by the time they become a Gerasim citizen. But relative to, you know, 200 million, okay, you know, it's not a huge percentage. So, you know, so just I wanted to, you know, remind you of that context. But still, nonetheless, Al, it's entirely possible that, you know, any of us, you know, might you know, be a Gerasim citizen, you know, before we fuse.
So those ratios imply that it's an abnormal ascender that would get.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bell curve to it. See, again, you know, like they say, I mean, basically, this, you know, most of them, you know, are fusing, say, around the fifth mansion world,
right.
You know. But there's a tail that goes way on. You know, you may get all the way to Salvington and haven't fused yet, right? And then discover, you know, you might fuse there. You might be one of those last that father fusers that don't fuse until you're on the local universe headquarters world, or you might be that really small subset that aren't a father fuser at all, right? And you discover on Salvington that you're a son fuser.
No.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very tiny, you know, fraction. But just remember, it's always a bell curve distribution. You always have this normal distribution, you know, and there's the ones that, you know, on the tail that fuse on their nativity sphere, and there's the ones that don't fuse, and, you know, until the local universe headquarters. So, you know, both extremes, but the majority, you know, and you can see the kind of the percentage there, you know, that, you know, a big number of those Gerasim citizens fused on the mansion worlds, you know, most, you know, big percentage did. Okay. Okay. Let's see. Anything else there? Let's see. You know, we'll be talking more about the whole rematerialization thing. I mean, I think most people are longtime readers, you know the basics there. But remember, there's that whole complexity of quote unquote rematerialized. You know what that involves. All right. Let's keep going. Oh, yep, you got a question?
Good question. William Idle was asking, how do the celestial beings from the rebellion of Telegastra sustain themselves?
If people couldn't hear that totally on the webinar, how do beings like Telegastra, rebel beings, sustain themselves? Remember, there's a very limited number of beings that kind of take care of themselves in rebellion, as it were. Right? I mean, if I achieve iniquity during this life, very difficult task, but let's, you know, say I did, I actually take that soul I have by grace and I hollow it out. I completely erase all meaning and value stored within that soul, so it's hollow. It's just an empty husk. I mean, there's nothing to resurrect, and in terms of my body, well, that takes care of itself, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. You know, any, you know, like the rebel staff, okay, they become mortals, and they just die, and then it takes care of itself. But if your body isn't made out of matter, so that the second law of thermodynamics just naturally, you know, turns it back into raw materials. Right, you've got this ongoing, immutable body, like a Lananadec, right? And once that personality makes that final choice to evacuate the upper domain and the hourglass analogy of their mind, you know, their effective soul, right? Once they totally evacuate that so that there's nothing there for personality to identify to, that final choice that basically erases the upper domain in the hourglass analogy, that's what the executioners, the Ancients of Days, are for, to turn the body back into raw materials, right? Because it doesn't do it itself. So they unravel it. Right? So all those beings that, you know, don't naturally unravel have to be artificially unraveled eventually once that final choice is made. They're effectively iniquitous, you know, like, say, Lucifer, you know, in the prison world right now. I mean, he's effectively empty. But there's that one, I mean, you know, the way we usually, you know, way you can simply think about it, the upper domain of his hourglass has nothing in it, but the upper domain is still there. It's empty, but there's that final choice to erase the vessel, as it were, right, that used to be filled with cosmic contents. That final step, that's why he's hasn't been turned into raw materials again. Okay, keep going.
These Jerusalemite volunteers were brought by seraphic transport direct from the system capital to Urantia, and upon arrival they were held in seraphimed until they could be provided with personality forms of the dual nature of special planetary service, literal bodies consisting of flesh and blood, but also attuned to the life circuits of the system.
Okay, so that first thing of a, you're going to build a dual body, body like ours, plus the additional plumbing and whatnot so that it can be plugged in to the life circuits of the system, you know, and secondary internal nature is what interfaces with the fruit of the tree of life. So they're brought and they're kept, in that, sleep transport state. Transport sleep state. until their literal bodies are built. Okay.
Sometime before the arrival of these 100 Jerusalem citizens, the two supervising life carriers resident on Urantia, having previously perfected their plans, petitioned Jerusalem and Edentia for permission to transplant the life plasm of 100 selected survivors of the Andon and Fanta stock into the material bodies to be projected for the corporeal members of the prince's staff. The request was granted on Jerusalem and approved on Edentia.
Okay, so the one little issue there is you're seeing how they're getting this permission and stuff. I mean, think about what's normal. Normally, you don't have the pre-Sangic race. And so, yeah, this whole question is like, I mean, you know that the red man is always first, and the prince comes basically immediately. On a normal world, are the prince's staff, like, are they all modeled after red man? Or what? I mean, you're kind of left to just, wonder, how does this work normally? Are they not modeled on any of the Sangiks at all? Do they have bodies that are built kind of more like Adamic bodies? It all depends, on what the plans are, for those individuals. Recall that the life carriers here had this grand plan that the prince's staff weren't going to just procreate offspring to be their replacements when they're taken back to Jerusalem when Adam and Eve arrived. Those offspring of the staff were going to be mated with the first generation children of Adam and Eve to produce that group of sort of philosophic leaders. Right? So they had plans, right, to they wanted the biology of the prince's staff, to be, you know, directly in play with the evolutionary biology here, and you know, as it is downstepped and attuned from Gerasim, you know, in our Adam and Eve, and then in their children, right? You know, we've talked about that. That you know, you when you rematerialize the Adam and Eve, they're synchronized a little bit more precisely with this world, and then and they're made so that when they procreate, their children are even more precisely synchronized with the mortals on that world. Right, so they had this plan, right? And so, you know, they were going to do this. But you wonder, on a normal world, how does this work? You know, I mean, it's probably all kinds of different variations. You know, maybe you have a normal staff that has all six sangic flavors, or like I said, maybe no sangics at all. I mean, who knows what all the different variations are.
How do they do this? They kill these guys and then take their bodies?
No, no. let's read the next paragraph before we talk about that. But you obviously had, again, this very uncommon opportunity to have the prince's staff be modeled after a pre-Sangic race. Yeah, that's a really, you know, really interesting opportunity. And see, and so again, see, Caligash, it's like, whoa, man, this is going to be so different. I mean, and then to mate those offspring, you know, with the first generation Adam and Eve, he was going to oversee all of this very uncommon stuff. He was very excited about this.
Yeah. Those are non-indexed tattoos.
Okay, anyway.
Doug Scott, I got a question.
Oh, yeah.
This is kind of a crazy question.
Yep.
Which ones have belly buttons and belly
buttons? Navel gazing. Yeah, could you prevent navel gazing if you didn't have a belly button?
But like the egg before the chicken.
Seriously. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you are you have those questions. You know, when they're literally building bodies for them, like Melchizedek's body, Machiavendi Melchizedek's body. Did he have a belly button?
Breastplate.
Oh, right. I mean, you have those issues, and I can't give you a definitive answer. You can only speculate, you know, about, you know, would there be slight variations like that? I mean. You know, you can speculate, for instance, like, well, you know, someone might see him with his shirt off. It might, you know, freak everyone out if he didn't have a belly button. So let's make him with a belly button. You know, it's difficult enough on every world for the to not have the situation where the natives are worshiping the prince's corporeal staff as gods in the first place. You know, and if they don't have belly buttons, that'll just add to it, right? Yeah. It seems like a trivial thing, but you know the way we are. Right. I mean, we turned Adam and Eve, you know, glowing in the dark into halos, you know. So, all right. Anyway, keep going.
Accordingly, 50 males and 50 females of the Andon and Fanta posterity, representing the survival of the best strains of that unique race, were chosen by the life carriers. With one or two exceptions, these Andonite contributors to the advancement of the race were strangers to one another. They were assembled from widely separated places by coordinated thought adjuster direction and seraphic guidance at the threshold of the planetary headquarters of the prince. Here, the 100 human subjects were given into the hands of the highly skilled volunteer commission from Avalon, who directed the material extraction of a portion of the life plasm of these Andon descendants. This living material was then transferred to the material bodies constructed for the use of the 100 Jerusalemite members of the prince's staff. Meantime, these newly arrived citizens of the system capital were held in the sleep of seraphic transport.
Yeah, you know, they'll talk about it some more later. You know, but you know, so they're using the germplasm. You know, setting aside hints like that about exactly the technique of how they're, you know, are they, how much are they growing these bodies at an accelerated rate? You know, how much are they building them? You know, setting all those technical issues aside. I mean, the basic thing is their, you know, their DNA, when all is said and done, their DNA is Andonic DNA, fundamentally, with some, a little bit of tweaking for the additional, you know, things that they've built into their bodies. And you've got, you know, we all know you've got the Avalon surgeons. And remember, we don't know how many different beings are involved, but you definitely have life carriers involved, you know, in overseeing the nitty-gritty of it. And it's like, well, why Avalon?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, remember, they point out that that must be our kind of our sister local universe that like to get training of seraphim going, you know, when you don't have any seraphim, pre-existent seraphim. Yeah, Avalon helps out with that. So, that's why Avalon and not, you know, Hanselon or something, right? Vanaving. But you know, here more specifically, I mean, they're literally working with this body. You can't have one of our life carriers, you know, they're working with those bodies, you know, in that, down in the trenches, interacting with it molecularly mode. You can't have one of our life carriers doing that because they're plugged into our Creative Mother Spirit. You don't want, the reproductive spark, you know, being re-bestowed through them. Right, so you take the life carriers from a neighboring local universe, right? They're taken, you know, they're having to be upgraded by that creative mother spirit so that they can go outside of that local universe, you know, unplugged from her mind womb, plugged into the super universe mind womb and brought over here. But see, are also unplugged from her in terms of having a reproductive spark re-bestowed like it was, back here 550 million years ago. Yeah, so, I mean, that's the main immediate reason why it's not our life carriers that are overseeing this. So that you'd
be the same on every planet.
Yeah, so, you know, every planet is, they've got to have, and apparently in our local universe, it's always from Avalon that they're coming over to do this. Now, you wonder, it's like, well, do we do this? Does our local universe life carriers, some of them do it for some other local universe? Probably, right? Yeah.
It's the exchange program.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's that very mysterious thing of how the coordination between the Thought Adjusters and the Guardian Seraphim is a mystery, right? But here's just more mystery upon the mystery of exactly how there's this sort of internal tweaking. I don't know. I've got this weird urge today to go in that direction, you know, or something. You know, however the heck this happens. I mean, you're wondering, it's like, does this require self-acting adjusters, or I don't know. I mean, you got a lot of speculation here.
And Gene was just asking me, what happened in the very first local unit?
Yeah. Right. Well, remember that some of the one of the ways that things get primed, you prime the pump out here, is you actually have beings coming out from the central universe, you know. Now, there's that also happening.
There was a creator-son situation.
Yeah, it was a little bit different in the central universe, right, for that, you know. But still, yeah, I mean, it is the pattern universe, and so, you know, it also initiates like that. You know, that would be the speculation.
Question.
Another question, yeah.
So are the corporeal staff going to look identical to the
host? I can't remember. Did they mention that here? Probably not right here. Somewhere here, they're going to look just basically like Andonites.
But their bodies were made first, and then the DNA was put into it.
Well, no. I mean, it's just no. I mean, it's just they're. Again, the body is, remember, the DNA is the pattern, right, that the body is predicated on. So, if you change my DNA, you're going to change my body expression, if you change my genotype, you're going to change my phenotype, to be biologic about it. You're going to change the expression of that genetic thing. So, I mean, yeah, they're going to look, they're going to have black hair like Andonites have, black eyes. I mean, they're going to be basically Andonite.
But would they be like identical twins?
But remember, that's only to start with. Again, if you go to, what's that, paper 77, isn't it? Paper 77. Because they're plugged into the, you know, as they call them here, the life circuits of the system, over time, their DNA changes. So that down the road a ways, they're much more like a material son and daughter genetically than Andonites, like they started out. Yeah, but it's, you know, but they're not going to be exactly like a material son and daughter, or what would be the point of, like I said, that whole experiment that they were going to do of having their children mate with the first offspring of Adam and Eve. You know? So there remains a differential, but they definitely moved quite a bit towards a more idealized material form rather than that more primitive Andonite form that they started with over time.
Yeah. So does that give us clues on transformation slower, but as we go through, you know, all the different...
I mean, remember, we don't have really... Most of that additional change in us, like we talked about, is going to be had through genetic engineering, but that would be the thing. See, eventually, when we're deep into light and life with this highly modified genetics that we've engineered so that we can be people in light and life. You know, genetically, we're completely inadequate to be in light and life right now. You know, we will have the mortals on those worlds in light and life, their morphology is very much like that idealized material son and daughter form.
Yeah, I was thinking.
Everyone ends up like that.
Yeah,
and then the same thing as you go on with your bodies, you know, on high, those are all, like we've talked about, you know, a Melchizedek can manifest himself materially, you know, or a secondary midwayer can manifest themselves materially, but, you know, even more significantly, a Melchizedek can, and what is he going to look like? He's going to look like that idealized material body form in that local system, right? There's a basic body. What kind of energy it's made out of is a secondary issue, but there's a basic body form that everyone is predicated on. You know, and then you're just left to wonder, it's like, well, if they're not going to be all identical, there must be little variations. Yeah, we'll get to discover all those little variations, especially when you actually have the ability of the personality to express itself more definitively through that form, so that you can differentiate from a kind of a group form, you know, of univitatia, right? To have a personality differentiation of your form that's heading towards that absolute uniqueness of your personality. Right? But again, no matter how absolutely unique the personalities of all the univitatia are, each of them is starting with a common form. Right? And it's going to be something like, you know, a material son and daughter form, you know, as well. Okay.
These transactions, together with the literal creation of special bodies for the Kaligashi 100, gave origin to numerous legends, many of which subsequently became confused with the later traditions concerning the planetary installation of Adam and Eve.
Yeah, I don't think I need to expand on that much. You know, that's just basically a statement where you go, oh, yeah, that's where that legend comes from and that sort of stuff. Right, all these ideas about immortals and, you name it. I mean, you know, we don't have to go into all the possibilities. But, you know, it's at this point that they start, you know, reminding of this that, you know, our myths don't just purely come out of our fertile imaginations, you know, like unicorns, okay? And a lot of it actually goes back to vague memories of actual facts.
Like unicorns.
No, unicorns weren't the animals, didn't make it on the ark. Yeah. Right, so there, that's a very fun thing. You know, this opens that whole doorway. Like the fact that there's secondary midwares. Okay, that has to have historical consequences.
Yeah.
Omnifim, no, but secondary midwares, yes, right. And same way here, a corporeal staff, that's got to have huge historical consequences. Adam, a real Adam and Eve, it's not a fairy tale. That's got to have huge historical consequences. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so it helps us to be a little bit more forgiving about the pleasing fables that people believe in, right?
There's a thread of truth.
And a lot of it has a thread of truth there. Okay.
The entire transaction of repersonalization from the time of the arrival of the seraphic transports bearing the 100 Jerusalem volunteers until they became conscious threefold beings of the realm consumed exactly 10 days.
Okay, just quickly the two little elements there. Threefold beings. I thought they said dual. Well, the body that was built for them was dual, but they already have a Marantia form, right? That was transported from Jerusalem, right? And that Marantia energy system is interfaced. They don't just have a little embryonic soul that's interfaced with their body like us. I mean, they have an entire Marantia form. It's gone all the way up to Jerusalem, a very relatively advanced Marantia form, energy form that's synchronized. So there's a threefold nature to their bodies. They already have bodies, but actually they have a Marantia body that is being and you're adding material body to it. And then the other thing, it consumed exactly 10 days. So they didn't just take, they didn't just do artificial insemination. They just didn't take a sperm cell and an egg cell, and then, grow it in a petri dish, right? Or if they did, they definitely accelerated it, okay?
if you use 9 women, you can do it in 1 minute.
maybe a little Miracle-Grow or something here, but you're just left to speculate, like I said, about how much of this is kind of quote unquote grown, maybe in some accelerated way, or how much is literally built, like the master physical controllers built an architectural sphere, one automaton at a time, they just build the whole sphere. What we don't know, the technology, but it's obviously a very advanced technology. Right? See, and they would have had to bring a lab. Right, to this world, right, or build a lab or something. I mean, they have to have a whole bunch of material technology and stuff, right? I mean, they aren't just waving magic wands to do this. You think about that. It's like, well, did they have a big tent or something? They had this all hidden, so all the natives aren't going, what the heck is all all those computers and. Right, what are they doing here? Huh? It would be some very sophisticated technology involved with this. Same way when they're rematerializing Adam and Eve. Remember, that's a whole technological thing. So you don't want to ever forget the science part of this is literal and very fascinating. Okay, we've gone way over. So that's the basics, and then we'll start getting into a day in the life of the prince and his staff next time here. And, I hope that was fun for everyone. This is always great stuff. It's as it starts to get so much more kind of immediate than talking about trilobites.
Well, you can't shut it down.
All right. Let's take a moment here, everyone.